On October 3rd, 2008, President George W. Bush signed the Great Lakes Compact into law. Eight states along the Great Lakes, including Wisconsin, signed onto the agreement, which dictated how the water would be managed. The 10 years since its signing, the Great Lakes Compact has faced some issues, and our next guest is here to talk about how the law has fared over the decade and what might challenge the agreement moving forward. Peter Annan is co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, which is coming out this fall in a new edition. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start with some news that, as far as I can tell, broke because of this new edition of your book. Information about a diversion plan for water that was really under the radar. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so back before the compact was adopted, under a prior water regulation mechanism called the Water Resources Development Act of 1986, Pleasant Prairie in extreme southeast Wisconsin on the shore of Lake Michigan had received a diversion of water for 3.2 million gallons per day. And that sort of sat there for years and years, and then the Great Lakes Compact gets adopted, as you said, in 2008. And one of the things that the states throughout the Great Lakes region had to do was report in to the Council of Great Lakes Governors and the Compact Council what existing diversions they already had and at what level, so that those could be grandfathered in under the compact. And when Wisconsin reported the Pleasant Prairie diversion, it tripled, more than tripled the amount from 3.2 million gallons per day to 10.69 million gallons per day.
And this is in the last year of the Doyle administration. Do we know why they tripled the allowance for Pleasant Prairie?
Yeah, so Wisconsin has an interesting statute that requires that the water delivery pipes need to match up geographically with the sewage pipes, so that the water that is delivered to a community marries up with the water that takes the plumbing that takes the dirty water away. And it turns out that Pleasant Prairie has a really large sewage system that needed to be matched by the delivery water. And so the state officials used that law as the reason to dramatically expand the Pleasant Prairie water diversion. But they reported that data, but they didn't publicly announce that data. And the amount that was increased in Pleasant Prairie exceeds the water diversion amount that Foxconn and Racine have applied for. And it's almost the amount that Waukesha got in 2016 in its water diversion application. So it's a significant increase in water. And that actually made Pleasant Prairie the largest municipal water diversion in the state, but nobody knew other than some officials at the DNR.
Yeah, under the spirit of the compact, is this something that should have, the case should have been made to the other states in the compact?
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Sort of the region is still kind of processing this news. Some environmental organizations are consulting some attorneys trying to figure it out. The state is quite confident that what they did was legal. But yeah, as you said, there have been a lot of questions about the spirit of the compact and the transparency. And the compact has really been an extraordinarily transparent document when it was being negotiated, when it was being adopted by the eight Great Lakes states Congress and signed by the president. There was a lot of really impressive transparency here, and the environmental organizations are sort of telling me that, look, we didn't think to check baseline, because baseline seems like it's the baseline. Why would anybody change the baseline? So they've been caught a bit off guard, and the region, the governor's office in Michigan said it's going to be reviewing things. And so, again, the news is just a couple weeks old since the book first came out, and so everyone's still processing it. But it's. I think we're going to hear a little bit more about Pleasant Prairie going forward.
Yeah, we'll be watching for developments. Let's take a step back now and talk about the compact more generally. What was the main goal of the Great Lakes Compact?
Yeah, so for decades and decades, there has been a fear that as the water situation in the United States and globally becomes more and more stressed, that there'll be increased global, regional, continental pressure on water-rich regions of the world, like the North American Great Lakes. So the compact was designed as what I call a legal water fence to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes Basin, so that the jobs come to the water rather than sending the water to the jobs somewhere else, agriculture, cities, etc.
And how far can we take water out of the Great Lakes? And there's some little gray areas, and the Waukesha story is part of that, but how much is diversion limited?
Yeah, so there are two key exception clauses in the Great Lakes Compact, and those are exception clauses for communities that straddle, sit right on top of that Great Lakes Basin line, that soup bowl rim of a watershed that surrounds the five North American Great Lakes. And then there's also a straddling county exception clause for communities that are in counties that straddle the basin line, but the communities themselves are clean and clear outside the Great Lakes Basin. And so those straddling county applicants, which is what Waukesha was, have a much higher bar than the straddling community applicants, which is an example would be New Berlin outside of Milwaukee. The straddling community applicants only need the approval of the local state, but Waukesha and other straddling county applicants need the approval of all eight Great Lakes governors, which is a super high bar. You gotta get all the approval from Minnesota to New York.
Talking to Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, about the Great Lakes Compact on the 10th anniversary of it being signed into law, and diversion efforts that have gone on in the last 10 years and those of the future, too. Peter, one that's got a lot of attention, you already mentioned it earlier, is the Foxconn, this huge corporate industrial development with its own diversion request. Can you put that in the context of the Great Lakes Compact?
Sure. And the Foxconn proposal really also was surprising to a lot of people, because the authors of the compact had told me that they didn't really envision a giant 13,000 employee facility actually straddling the Great Lakes Basin line. So we've talked about straddling communities. We've talked about straddling counties. Well, the Foxconn situation brought up a straddling corporation. It literally, the facility, which is going to be the size of three Pentagons, is sort of partially inside the Great Lakes watershed and partially out of it. Because it's partially out of it, it required, it was needed a water diversion application. It's located in the community of Mount Pleasant, which is just west of Racine. Mount Pleasant doesn't have its own water supply system. It gets its water from Racine. Thereby, Racine applies for the water diversion on behalf of Mount Pleasant, which is in part applying on behalf of Foxconn. And so that sort of stirred things up in new ways, because there's a debate going on and a legal challenge now, which was filed in May, asking the question whether or not water was meant to be diverted for corporations, because there's language in the compact that says the water really is for public water supply purposes, primarily residential in nature.
Now, we hear about the volume of water that goes to some of these projects we're talking about, and, millions of gallons, which sounds like a lot. Does a diversion like the Waukesha one or the Foxconn plan, compared to the volume of the Great Lakes, do they really make that much of a difference?
Yeah, they do not. And you're right. Those numbers sound like they're big, 7 to 8 million gallons per day. But if you have 6 quadrillion gallons in the Great Lakes, which is a number that's so large it's hard for people to wrap their head around it. But these diversions we're talking about would really be immeasurable if somebody tried to measure the impact that they would have on the Great Lakes. And it's important to remember that one of the key changes that the Great Lakes brought, the Great Lakes Compact brought to the water diversion debate, is that it requires that this water all be returned to the Great Lakes after it's cleaned to Clean Water Act standards and discharged to the water body. So the idea there'd be really no net loss under these water diversions. But throughout the history of the Great Lakes water diversion debate and concern, it's never really been about any one water diversion creating damage in and of itself to the Great Lakes water levels. It's the fact that there could be precedent that could be set that could sort of lead to sort of a death or destruction by a thousand straws, if you will, that there's some kind of camel's nose gets in into the process and then creates a legal precedent by which it could be expanded by future diversions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, the Great Lakes Compact with this, just only allowing water diversions, all of which have to be returned for communities on or near the Great Lakes Basin line, really reined things in. Because if you're not a community that's on the basin line or just outside it, you can't even request a Great Lakes water diversion. So the lakes really have never before been better protected. And what we see after 10 years of the Great Lakes Compact is, we're working into new areas, the document's being tested, the legal mechanism is being tested. And it's like at a conference at Marquette University yesterday, I sort of referred to it as a 10-year-old child. It's not even a teenager yet. And it's normal for these complex environmental pieces of legislation to sort of work things through over time.
We're talking to Peter Annan right now, co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. He's with us to talk about the 10 years of the Great Lakes Compact and challenges facing the Great Lakes Water Basin today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the Great Lakes Compact and how it works? What do you think about laws regulating the Great Lakes? Do you worry about diversions to places like Waukesha or the Foxconn plant? Or if you're in Waukesha itself, are you glad that things have worked out to allow you to use that water? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Great Lakes Compact on the 10th anniversary of its signing into law. Peter Annan is with us, co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the Great Lakes should be managed? Should companies like Foxconn be able to draw water out of the lakes? About cities on that Great Lakes basin, just on the other side maybe of a county from that basin? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. I wonder, well, what about paying for cleaning up? Because I've heard many times about Milwaukee's sewer system spewing out sewage into Lake Michigan. And, well, how is that being cleaned up, or is it being cleaned up, and who pays for that?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Peter, water, not quantity here, but quality.
Yeah, and the compact just is strictly related to water quantity and diversions and things like that, and as a primary regulatory document. Secondarily, it does require, as I said, that any water that's withdrawn from the lake and used needs to be cleaned to Clean Water Act standards before it's returned. The Milwaukee situation is a very important one, as Dennis mentions, but Milwaukee's inside the Great Lakes Basin already, so it's really a water quality issue dealing with sewer system, and they've got their deep tunnel that they're working on there, and a super important issue. But the issue of the compact is really a water quantity one, not a water quality one.
So for a city or a corporation, for that matter, emitting polluted water into the Great Lakes, that would be something in the U.S. that would be covered by the Clean Water Act, not by the Great Lakes Compact. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Michael in Bear Valley. Michael, hello.
Hello. Well, my question is similar. I was concerned about the quality of the water that goes back into the lake. And hello, are you there?
Yep, keep going, Michael.
Okay, yes. So who determines, you said the Clean Air and Water Act has a say in that, but who actually will be monitoring the water that eventually, if it happens, comes out of Foxconn and goes back into the lake? Is it a local community? The DNR, who is actually involved with that, and to what extent is science involved in the determination?
Michael, thanks for the call. So with that specific example of Foxconn needing to return that water that's been extracted, how does that work in terms of the water quality of what they return?
Yeah, great question. And these were also concerned with the Waukesha water diversion as well, which we didn't mention yet, but it's also being returned to the Great Lakes via a pipeline that then leads to the Root River and then outflows at the city of Racine. And so there's been a robust debate about that with water diversions. There have been concerns raised about it with Foxconn because of the industrial process. But to specifically answer Michael's question, is the DNR permitting and then also under the Federal Clean Water Act, so you have the federal government's Clean Water Act and then the state of Wisconsin enforcing the Clean Water Act on behalf of the federal government. If there's any case where the federal government thinks that Wisconsin is not doing an adequate job of enforcing those federal rules, then there is a process for the federal government to come in and take that over from the state. And there can be citizen suits that make that happen or appeals, et cetera. And so there's sort of a multi-layered process, but the permitting, the monitoring, that sort of thing is conducted by the Department of Natural Resources.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Peter, let's get at the Waukesha story. We've mentioned it briefly a couple times, but that has been maybe the biggest story of the Great Lakes Compact in the last 10 years. We've talked about it a lot. We've talked to you about it as it ran its course. But looking back now, where we are, talk about that story and what it said about the Great Lakes Compact.
Yeah, well, Waukesha was the first major test case of the Great Lakes Compact. And as most of your listeners will probably remember, so you have a community of 70,000 people, roughly, and it's just slightly outside, a few miles outside the Great Lakes Basin. It's sitting on top of a depleted and naturally contaminated deep groundwater system, and naturally contaminated with radium, a naturally occurring radioactive element in the groundwater. So the city was under state and federal pressure to either clean up the water, find an alternate water source, et cetera. And so Waukesha eventually decided to apply for a Great Lakes water diversion in May of 2010. That was heavily vetted by the Department of Natural Resources for 5 years before the department felt it was ready to circulate with the other seven Great Lakes governors for approval. And then those governors spent 6 months reviewing Waukesha's water diversion application and changed it fairly significantly. They reined in the geographic scope of the diversion by about 50%, and they reduced the requested amount from 10.1 million gallons per day to 8.2 million gallons per day. And it was a close call there in the end. The state of Minnesota had the most concerns about the Waukesha water diversion. Again, all it takes is one state to say no, and Waukesha would have been out of luck. But in the end, Minnesota did join the other Great Lakes governors in approving the Waukesha water diversion for 8.2 million gallons per day. And so where we are right now is the city of Waukesha, which will be getting its water from the city of Milwaukee. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, returning it eventually via the Root River to Lake Michigan at Racine, is now sort of in the process of putting in that infrastructure, A, to get the water from Milwaukee, and then B, to return it by pipeline to the Root River and then have that flow upstream from the Root River down to Lake Michigan.
As you mentioned earlier, one worry is about, okay, if we approve this, whatever it is, Waukesha, Foxconn, does this set a precedent? Do we have other Waukeshas out there in these straddling counties making their applications now?
Yeah, and that was the concern. And yeah, just to be clear, so this does set precedent, but only for other Waukesha-like situations, other potential straddling county applicants. Waukesha's approval does not set a precedent for long-range, far-flung diversions to some other state or country. No other straddling community applicants have stepped forward. You know, it took Waukesha something like, I don't know, $5 million and years and years and years. And so one of the questions is, was the process Waukesha went through so intimidating that we're not going to see any or not very many straddling county applicants stepping forward in the future? Or is there just not a burning need in any specific community that we've heard about yet? And so it's sort of a, you know, stay tuned situation. In the meantime, we've had more straddling community applications from, you know, with the Foxconn situation and the Racine application that was submitted earlier this year. So in the end, it turns out, and Wisconsin residents may not realize this, but Southeast Wisconsin is really a hot spot for water diversions. There are more water diversion hotspots in Southeast Wisconsin than all other Great Lakes states combined. And so when we haven't talked about the diversion at Chicago, which is the largest diversion in the Great Lakes and 100 years old, but you take the controversy in Chicago, the controversy in southeastern Wisconsin, that's what I call that front line in the Great Lakes water war, that sort of Milwaukee-Chicago megacity corridor. And again, we're going to hear Pleasant Prairie's in that area as well. So I think we're just going to continue to hear more and more about the water diversion issue here in Wisconsin for years to come.
Talking to Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. Back to your calls now. Dan is with us in Madison. Dan, hello.
Hi. So I was just wondering, I know that this is like a United States agreement. How does Canada play into all this? Because I know they straddle a lot of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, Peter, Canada.
Yeah, and this gets complicated, but Canada has been right there shoulder to shoulder with the eight Great Lakes states on this. As Dan mentioned, the Great Lakes are an international boundary water, and the complexity was how, with two provinces in a different country and then eight states in here in the United States, we want to surround the entire Great Lakes basin with this legal paradigm that keeps Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes. And so what happened was there's actually two agreements. I've only been talking about the Great Lakes Compact so far because that's generally what American audiences want to hear. But there's also agreements with Ontario and Quebec that implement the same rules and regulations on the Canadian side of the Great Lakes as the Great Lakes Compact has implemented in the eight states stretching from New York to Minnesota, thereby enveloping that whole international boundary water in the same rules and regulations. The only difference is that Canadian provinces do not have a veto authority over the eight Great Lakes states' water diversion applications. So the Canadians had a voice in Waukesha, but not a vote. And the same holds true in Canada, is that the eight Great Lakes governors can express their opinion about water diversion proposals in Canada, but in the end, the Canadians will make a decision on what happens on their side of the international border. It's a great question.
Thanks for that call, Dan. Very briefly, Peter, just a few seconds. Despite these concerns on the ground, overall, is this a successful agreement?
Yeah, I think the general sense is that the compact is working. I mean, some people aren't happy with some of the decisions that are made, but the process overall is working. I think even most of the critics of some of the decisions will agree with that. And in the end, that was the secret, was how are we going to set up a process to have this be, in an organized fashion, be judged by the governors and premiers in the Great Lakes region. And overall, I think things have held up pretty well.
Peter, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Peter Annan from Northland College. He's the author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. We've been talking about the 10-year anniversary of the Great Lakes Compact.